Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Teddy Kupfer of National Review is in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis and a champagne toast to close out the week. We should point out that Teddy is not only filling Jim's shoes today on the Three Martini Lunch, he's writing the Morning Jolt all of next week. So, Teddy, I hope you've done a full character study of Jim Garrity here.
I've been reading the Morning Jolt. I went back, found the archives, been reading them 6 months back just to prepare.
Wow. That is excellent prep work. So
it's also not true.
He'd be very impressed to hear that, though. So
yeah.
He doesn't need to know that it's not true. All right, let's move on to the good martini today. And the good news here, Teddy, is that, you know, in years past, before Trump was president, Fridays were pretty slow news days. Not anymore. So we've got plenty of fodder to choose from today. Let's start with news that broke last evening. Donald Trump, just a week after saying through his spokesperson, Sarah Sanders, that there was going to be no major shakeup in the National Security Council. Lo and behold, there's a major shakeup at the top of the National Security Council. Trump tweets last night, "I am pleased to announce that effective April 9th of 18, Ambassador John Bolton will be my new National Security Advisor. I'm very thankful for the service of General H.R. McMaster, who has done an outstanding job and will always remain my friend. There will be an official contact handover on April 9th. So John Bolton is well known in conservative circles. He worked in the Reagan administration. He, of course, started with the State Department in the George W. Bush administration, eventually became the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. Folks who watch Fox News know him well. He favors a muscular foreign policy, to say the least. A lot of folks on the left hate this pick. They think he's going to start bombing everything. They also say he should not get a plum job like this, given how much in favor of the Iraq war he was. But in the end, Teddy, I think he's probably going to be more in line with Trump because John Bolton and Trump both hate the Iran deal. They probably see eye to eye on North Korea, and it's good to have these things in sync at the top of your national security chain of command.
Yeah, I agree. The job of the National Security Advisor is not to be some rogue agent implementing your own foreign policy. It's to advise the president and implement his foreign policy and make sure it's implemented well. I think H.R. McMaster did a good job. I think you needed somebody in there, especially during Trump's first year, who had the experience. But if you look around the world, there are mounting threats. Iran is more unstable. Russia is gaining influence in the Middle East with their activity in Syria. American troops confronted Russian mercenaries a few weeks ago. And then, of course, there's the whole business with North Korea. Bolton is going to bring a combative approach, and that's going to ultimately amount to a unified foreign policy within the Trump administration. He's gotten a lot of criticism from the left, as you said, Greg, with his background in the Iraq war, his general hawkishness, which, you know, he is a hawk. He's one of the most prominent hawks in the foreign policy establishment. But he is a hawk in the sense that he's not hesitant to cast off international obligations if they threaten American interests. He withdrew from the treaty that had us in the International Criminal Court. He fought Americans being extradited to the ICC. During his time at the Bush administration, he also withdrew from the 1972 ABM treaty so we could strengthen our own missile defense. So this is the kind of America first. I know it's a cliche, but this is the kind of America first, focus on American interests, internationalism that Trump campaigned on. I know Trump campaigned on a bit less of a hawkish note. He criticized the war in Iraq. But I think given what you see now mounting around the world, you're going to get a much more unified and coherent foreign policy from the Trump administration with Bolton in the NSA.
Teddy, a lot of folks are looking at this change, and especially after what Trump, or at least the White House, said last week about no changes coming. But in the meantime, we got the big dust up over the do not congratulate memo that Trump ignored, and then somehow it ended up in the Washington Post, and Trump was clearly not very happy about that. Neither is John Kelly. How much do you think that may have played into, yes, now is time to make a change?
It might have. I mean, there were reports that Trump was infuriated by that leak. I mean, it was a leak. There's a small group of people who know about what's written on the president's intelligence briefings. I have to say, on the merits, I was very disappointed to see Trump call Putin, especially just a couple weeks after he attacked a spy on British soil. But if you're Donald Trump, you don't want these leaks coming from your house. You just don't want to see it. And so maybe he felt the time was now to send a signal, to send a message.
I saw one person out there, and this, of course, is the most important question of the day. Will Bolton actually shave the mustache now that he's got such a high-profile national security position? I tweeted out yesterday that if there's anything that's a certainty anymore in Washington, it's that the mustache stays. What's your position?
Mustache has got to stay. It's a populist mustache. It's a mustache that screams America. No, I mean, look, it's funny because you heard back when Trump was filling out his cabinet that one of the reasons he didn't prefer Bolton for state is because he didn't like the mustache. He wants people at a central casting. But I guess maybe it says something that he's come around on the mustache issue.
Wow. I forgot about that. Yes, that was actually
a real thing.
A demerit against John Bolton for Secretary of State. Amazing. All right, let's go on to our bad martini now. And Teddy, Jim and I talked about this a couple days ago when it looked like the leaders of the House and Senate had kind of cobbled together the framework of this $1.3 trillion omnibus bill. But since then, we found out just how truly horrific it is. Not only is it $1.3 trillion in new spending, it's still got all the money for Planned Parenthood, doesn't have money for sanctuary cities. And I know you've written about this, and you're going to elaborate on it in a number of different ways here in a moment. But not only is it chock full of things we don't like, and other than military spending, not a lot of what we would like. The Republicans here, not just the leadership, going along with this. The vote in the House was 256 to 167, with 145 Republicans voting for it, 90 against it. And in the Senate, the vote was 65 to 32, 25 Republicans supporting it, 23 opposed, and 3 weren't there. So not only are the leadership not honoring their promises to voters, but most of the rank and file seem to be going along as well.
It's a real disappointment for the GOP. Look, during the Obama administration, you heard a lot of complaints about the budgets that were being passed. You heard complaints about the process. They were being passed in the dead of night with a gun to your head, pass this bill or we'll shut down the government. You heard a lot about how we were spending too much. Our debt was growing and we were just racking up increasing deficits. And you heard a lot about bad substance. You know, frankly, we were funding the wrong programs. There was waste. There was abuse. There was duplication. There were outdated programs. So let's take a look at this bill. Okay, it was drafted in secret by congressional leaders. It was introduced on Wednesday night. If it wasn't passed by Friday, which they passed it yesterday, and Trump, we'll see if he signs it. He's been saying he might veto it, and you don't know if that's a gimmick or not. But look, if it doesn't become law by Friday, the government's going to shut down. So on the process complaint, they're doing exactly what they complained about 10 years ago. The spending, there's a 13% increase in discretionary spending, which they had to dangle in order to get the military spending. You know, conservatives will like the military spending, and I'm one of those. But it's amazing that the Republicans, with unified control of the government, still have to dangle this extra spending on domestic programs. As our debt mounts, this bill is going to blow up the deficit. Bob Corker, I think he mentioned it's going to increase the deficit by trillions of dollars. And then if you look at the substance, lastly, look, on immigration, we have a president who campaigned on tightening the immigration system. Well, guess what? This bill gives him 1/25th of the amount of border enforcement that he asked for. And there's restrictions on the immigration, the money going to internal and border enforcement. For example, there's $1.6 billion going to ICE, but ICE is limited in how they can use it. How many illegal immigrants can they detain per year? The bill actually places a cap on that. There's infrastructure money, $21 billion, but it's not paired with any deregulation, only increasing the chance that a push for infrastructure is nothing more than a boondoggle. You wanted to see some kind of permitting reform, something making it easier for companies to invest. Don't get any of that. And then on healthcare, they've kind of given up. There's no deregulations of the Obamacare regime. There's no money to fund the cost-sharing reduction payments that Trump ended a few months ago. All that adds up to rising premiums and, you know, Obamacare's continuing drag on our healthcare system. So it's really bad on all fronts. The Republicans were bad on process. There's too much money, and they're spending the money in the wrong places. And for a party that ran on reforming the budgetary process, and for a Congress where the budgetary process is really all it does anymore, it's just kind of a disgrace that they couldn't come up with anything better.
We always hear, and we've talked about this earlier in the week, that Paul Ryan, and he's right about this, is that the House went through regular order. They pass separate appropriations bills. They get to the Senate, and then they die there because they need 60 votes, and they can't get, obviously, the 9 Democrats, even if you get all the Republicans to stick together and they all show up, to get to 60 votes. And so that's a major problem. But the Republicans won't even hold votes on these things in the Senate to put the Democrats on the spot. So as we look towards the midterm elections here, Teddy, are we seeing a party that's essentially banking its entire hopes on the fact that they passed tax cuts? Or do they actually think that people aren't going to pay attention to this?
I don't know. I mean, it looks like tax cuts are the only legislative achievement that Congress can point to. This omnibus may well be the only significant piece of legislation we get this year. And if that's the case, I don't know what the Republicans are going to run on besides a tax bill that, yes, had some good elements, yes, is growing more popular. But, you know, Republicans ran on more than just tax cuts, and they're not going to get anything else.
Yeah, absolutely right. And so, and then Trump tweeted that, when you mentioned that he was thinking about a veto. We'll see if it happens. By the time folks hear this, they might know. He says, I'm considering a veto of the omnibus spending bill based on the fact that the 800,000 plus DACA recipients have been totally abandoned by the Democrats, not even mentioned in the bill, and the border wall, which is desperately needed for our national defense, is not fully funded. And you could argue that it's not really funded at all, since it doesn't allow for construction of an actual wall, just maintenance of existing fencing and so forth.
Exactly.
So in terms of what Trump's willing to do here, because by the time the next fiscal year gets dealt with, we may very well be after the election, at which point the Democrats might control one or both chambers of the Congress here. So if the president allows this to get punted again, he might never get anything close to what he wants with the wall.
He might not. The problem with vetoing the bill now is I just think the two parties are too far apart on DACA. They already tried to negotiate this once. It failed. They tried to do it again. It failed. And the idea, there is a deal to be had, right? Trade protection for the DACA recipients for a meaningful tightening of the immigration system, whether it's the wall, whether it's E-Verify, something else. I think the Democrats are too radicalized on the issue. They don't want to tighten the immigration system. And I think the Republicans are not creative enough to come up with a deal. So Trump may want to bluster about a veto, but I think eventually cooler heads are going to prevail. We're going to get this disappointment of a bill, and there's going to be inaction on all fronts.
All right, let's move to our crazy martini now, Teddy. And I have to start with a personal question. You consider yourself a millennial?
Yes.
Well, this is not going to bode well for your generation, although there is a significant percentage of people who I'm guessing will agree with your position on this. This is courtesy of Hot Air, which is doing a story on a YouGov.com poll. Millennials like doing taxes. And the way that Ala Pundit over at Hot Air puts it, we failed as a people to raise our children right. And now we face a generation of monsters. Yes, according to a YouGov poll, millennials actually like doing their taxes. They asked them four different ways to respond. How do you like doing your taxes? Do you enjoy it a lot? Do you enjoy it somewhat? Do you not enjoy it very much? Or do you not enjoy it at all? Overall, 11% enjoy it a lot. This is the entire population, not millennials. 23% enjoy it somewhat. 30% don't enjoy it very much. And 32% don't enjoy it at all. But among millennials, 22% enjoy it a lot. 30% enjoy it somewhat. So 52% like doing taxes at one level of enthusiasm or another. 23% don't enjoy it very much, and 19% don't enjoy it at all. Compare that to the 55 and over crowd, where 43% don't enjoy it at all and 33% don't enjoy it very much, which is 76%. So according to Ala Pundit, there's two ideas here. One is that they enjoy doing their taxes because they get to use this cool software and most people get a refund. So they think they're getting money from the government when really they're just getting their money back with no interest that they had they could take it out of their paychecks. And he says the other thing is that the millennials are trending more towards far left politics, and in particular, millennial women. Right now, 70% of millennial women, that's 18 to 34, 70% are Democrats or lean that direction, just 23% Republican or lean Republican, whereas with millennial men, it's 49% lean Democrat, 41% lean towards the right. So, Teddy, I'm guessing you are in that 19% that doesn't enjoy it at all, but I could be wrong. What do you make of your generation here?
Yeah, there's this idea we like giving our money to the government because we're more charitable. I don't think that's the answer. I think it's true that my generation is more left-wing than older generations. So I think that's true about young people every time you have new young people. Yeah, I have to say I don't understand my fellow millennials. I'm 22. I don't understand my fellow millennials who like paying their taxes. But I do have a theory. I think Ala Pundit is onto something when it comes to this software. Let me tell you something, Greg. I watch a lot of sports, and yeah. I've watched a lot of sports growing up. On commercial breaks during sporting events, you get some of the most intense commercials advertising tax software. You have TurboTax, you have Quicken, you have all these different technologies, and that's, you know, people are into it, I guess. If you fill in a couple digits on a computer and you get some money back, people my age aren't so good at thinking about the citizens' relationship with the government. And so it kind of seems like you're just punching in numbers and getting free money out of it. I would say that's more of the rationale than people just like to give their money to the government.
If you're a sports fan, Teddy, how's your bracket doing?
Absolutely destroyed. I had Arizona over Michigan State in the final. I liked Arizona. I thought they had good NBA players. I liked Tom Izzo. I thought he'd take his team to the final. I got crushed, but I think everyone else did too this season.
Well, the entire left side of the bracket is a major implosion unless somebody had Michigan coming out of there. The right side is a little more traditional, but we'll see what happens tonight. We could see some other marquee names going down. But yeah, it's interesting that that's what millennials take away from sporting commercials. But I guess that's the best positive spin, though, right? I mean, I'd rather have them being attracted by cool technology than being attracted by Marxism. I'll take that.
That's a good trade.
All right. We said at the top that there is a champagne toast, and regular Three Martini Lunch listeners know that what that means. That means that someone of prominence has passed away, and we want to take a moment to pay tribute to them. Today, it is former Georgia Governor and Senator Zell Miller, who died at the age of 86. He was a governor first, and I think most conservatives know him more as a senator. In 2000, he was appointed to fill out the term of a Republican senator named Paul Coverdell, who had died. And Zell Miller ended up serving the last 4 years of that term. And he became famous for crossing over the aisle and endorsing the reelection of George W. Bush in the 2004 election against John Kerry. And not only did he endorse President Bush, he spoke and gave the keynote address at the Republican National Convention in New York City, which, of course, was the first convention post 9/11. And one of the big things during that campaign was having a strong national defense and being able to carry out the war in Iraq and the general war on terrorism. So Zell Miller goes on this long list of critical military programs that have already paid huge dividends in the, to that point, less than 3 years of the war on terror, and how they're all things that John Kerry opposed, like the B-1 bomber, the B-2 bomber, the F-14A Tomcat, the F-14D, Apache helicopters, and the F-15 Eagles. And here's how he wrapped it up in the speech that brought the convention to its feet.
I could go on and on and on against the Patriot missile that shot down Saddam Hussein's Scud missiles over Israel, against the Aegis air defense cruiser, against the Strategic Defense Initiative, against the Trident missile, against. This is the man who wants to be the commander-in-chief of the U.S. Armed Forces. U.S. Forces armed with what? Spitballs?
Oh, Teddy, Democrats at one time, at least a lot of them, liked a strong military. They liked tax cuts. Zell Miller co-sponsored the 2001 Bush tax cuts. He was pro-life. Once upon a time, there were rational Democrats, and it's the passing of the torch when a guy like him passes away.
Talk about a rare breed. That was a very well-delivered speech. Talk about a skilled orator. I noticed something in Zell Miller's biography that is very clever. He instituted a program in Georgia to fund scholarships through the lottery, which is just a great way to use lottery funds if I've ever heard of one.
Yes. Yeah, usually the lottery ends up being kind of a boondoggle, but that was a very clever way to do it. And, you know, it wasn't that long ago. It was only 14 years ago he makes that speech. Can you imagine any prominent Democrat coming anywhere close to that now?
Now they'd be excommunicated from the party. It would be a disaster.
Unbelievable. But he profile encouraged that year because people on the left now think or at least pretend that they weren't as harsh towards George W. Bush back then. They sure were. They were calling him Hitler all the time. And for Zell Miller to break away and not only endorse him, but actually take the stage at the convention was quite a moment. So, Teddy, great to have you with us today. Fantastic job. Good luck with the jolt next week. And I'm sure we'll be chatting down the road.
Thank you, Greg. Good to be here.
Thank you. Teddy Kupfer in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Have a great weekend, everyone, and please tune in on Monday for the next Three Martini Lunch.